At a high level, what we're trying to do is just calculate the observables of single-field Sorel inflation. So what single-field Sorel inflation is, of course, is a model for the early universe with two fields, the metric and a scalar field phi, with this action. A minimally coupled scalar on a potential, where V of phi, slow roll means V of phi is a flat potential, meaning that the technical flatness condition is that these parameters, which I'll use frequently, are small. These are essentially the first and derivatives of log V in Planck units. Epsilon is always positive, but eta can have either sign. I'm going to choose the sign so that positive phi is downhill. Okay, and then the problem is just to calculate in this model the observables, which, as we talked about last time, are the scalar power spectrum at the end of inflation. Zeta here, haven't actually told you what zeta is in terms of these constituent fields, but it's a quantity that's conserved at late times that I'll define as the calculation progresses. The gravity wave power spectrum and finally the three-point function, the scalar three-point function, which we said last time was an interesting observable, and by computing its size, we'll get some idea of how good the approximation of a Gaussian field is. Yeah.
So there's no kinetic term or not, but it includes dt term as well, or
Oh yeah, this is the covariant four derivative. This is g mu nu. G mu nu delta phi. Okay. This Maldacena paper represents, even though it's, I guess, a 13-year-old vintage, it still represents sort of our best technical understanding of how to calculate these quantities, especially the three-point function, in a way which is, completely rigorous and free of loopholes. It's interesting that the calculation is so long and involved. Over the weekend, I tried to reproduce the key calculations of this paper, and it took forever. It was way more of an algebraic saga than I thought it would be. I think that's sort of interesting. It made me wonder, I missed a square here. It makes you wonder what's going on. Is this really so inherently complicated, or are we missing some other way of doing it? I think this is sort of an interesting, maybe just a technical problem, maybe a better understanding of what's going on here would lead to improvements in other things. I think it's sort of interesting and fun, so I'll spend the next couple of days talking about it. I'm going to try to strike a compromise between just presenting a big picture with no a misleadingly simple big picture by omitting all details of calculations and just getting lost in a forest of calculations. So we'll talk about some of doing these calculations, I think, requires some tricks. If you try to do them by pure brute force, you're just in for like a lonely life of pure algebra. I'll talk about some of the technical tricks that are sort of interesting. First, let me talk about the background, the solution of these equations at zeroth order in the fluctuation. That is just going to be a special case of the FRW solution. So at zeroth order, the solution of this theory is an FRW metric. I'm taking curvature to be zero here. I suppose you could probably include curvature, but it would inflate away pretty quickly. And a phi value, which is a function of time. And the exact equations of motion are found by varying this action in a special case, in the special case where you just have this FRW form of the metric and no space dependence in any of the fields. So the equations of motion are easily shown to be, the equation of motion for A is h squared is 1/3. That's Friedman's equations in, I forgot to say that following Maldacena, I'm going to generally assume M Planck is 8 pi g to the minus 1/2. I'm going to generally set that to 1, but I'll sometimes restore the M Planck's. If you read Maldacena's paper, the main notational thing that he does differently is he parameterizes the scale factor by rho equals log A. So that rho dot equals h. So you'll see rho's all over the paper instead of a's and h's. So this is the equation of motion for A, and the equation of motion for phi, the Klein-Gordon equation with no spatial fluctuations, is this. Now, the slow roll approximation, we might intuitively imagine that if the potential is flat and the field is rolling slowly, you know, that we can make some approximations here. Like the phi dot squared becomes small as the potential flattens out. So we might imagine, you know, it's a good approximation to the A equation of motion to just get rid of that term. Likewise, in the phi equation of motion, you know, in a slowly rolling situation, you might imagine that the friction term here is just the field instantaneously adjusts its velocity so that the friction term just instantaneously matches the slope of the potential. In other words, the phi double prime term in this equation is smaller than the other two. So the other approximation you might make is that phi dot is approximately minus v prime over 3h, you know, where h, you could plug this in and relate it to. So also in the slow roll approximation, this is minus v prime over root 3 v to the 1/2. Let's check that this is a consistent approximation. So is this approximation self-consistent? Well, if you imagine that you integrated these equations of motion, so these are a pair of first-order differential equations for A and phi, whereas the true equation of motion is a first-order differential equation and a second-order differential equation, that it's self-consistent if on the slow roll solution, the solution to the approximate equations of motion, yes, if on the slow roll solution, we can plug back in and check that the terms that we neglected are small compared to the others. So we want to check that phi dot squared over v is small. And we want to check that phi double dot, let's say phi dot squared is small compared to v. And we want to check that phi double dot is small compared to, say, 3h phi dot. And you can do that. So on the slow roll solution, you can evaluate both sides here in terms of the parameters epsilon and eta. For example, phi dot squared, let's compute phi dot squared over v. On the slow roll solution, phi dot squared is v prime squared over 3v by this equation. And v is, let's just leave that as v. So I get 1/3 v prime squared over v squared, which is 2/3 epsilon, where this is the definition of epsilon. So that is indeed much less than 1. It's a straightforward exercise, which I won't write out, to show that if you compare phi double dot to h phi dot, if you do the algebra here, you get eta minus epsilon. The second derivative of the potential comes in because I took the second derivative of phi to compute phi double dot. I would differentiate this equation with respect to time, which I do by differentiating with respect to phi and multiplying by phi dot. So that's how v double prime enters the equation, which is also much less than 1. So this is actually a priori, if you were thinking about a slowly rolling scalar field, it would be intuitive, I think, to write down this flatness condition. Slowly rolling requires that the derivative be small. It's not so obvious that the second derivative also needs to be small to have a nice slow roll hierarchy. But it drops out when you try to check that the slowly rolling approximation is self-consistent. If epsilon was small but eta was large, what would happen is that the phi double dot term in this equation becomes important, and the field would start accelerating down the hill, and you would leave the slow roll regime. Another equation. Let's see. I forgot to put it on the original list, but another equation that follows from these two and is useful when doing calculations is that h dot is minus 1/2. If you compute h dot by differentiating the first equation and then use the equation of motion for phi to get rid of the phi double dot term, you find that h dot is just given by minus 1/2 phi dot squared. That's exact, not something that's true to leading order in slow roll. So in the slow roll situation, we have sort of a nice hierarchy where things are slowly varying, derivatives of things are small, and as we add more derivatives, things just get smaller and smaller. Like phi double dot squared is small compared to phi double dot is small compared to phi dot. Phi dot itself is small. H dot is small, that's slow roll suppressed. H double dot would be even smaller, and so on. So everything's nice and hierarchically ordered. The one thing which is not slowly varying is the scale factor, which of course is near De Sitter. So locally, the scale factor looks like e to the ht, but if you wait a long time, you can see h is slightly time dependent. That's the background. Background solution. Now, our challenge here is going to be to understand the quantum mechanical perturbations, the quantum mechanics of fluctuations around this background. This is just going to be at tree level. What we're going to do is expand this, and to compute that, since we want to compute a three-point function, we're going to need to do this to third order. We're going to expand this action to third order in fluctuations around this background, figure out how to organize things so that the action looks like a perturbative field theory with a bunch of canonically normalized time-dependent harmonic oscillators with some small interaction term, and then run the interaction picture to compute the solve the free theory, compute the two-point function, run the interaction picture, and compute the three-point function. That's going to be very complicated to work out because GR is a complicated nonlinear theory. So the challenges here, the technical challenges, will just be doing all of the differential geometry, all the GR math, to wrangle the action into the form that we need. It will probably help to outline the main steps in this calculation up front. So the first thing we're going to do is just change the action to the so-called ADM variables, which are a reparameterization of general relativity, which is convenient when you want to do any sort of Hamiltonian analysis. I'm going to keep track of the basic degrees of freedom as we go along. Then we're going to fix the gauge. I'll define the ADM variable shortly. Then we're going to fix the gauge. I'll describe exactly what that means too, which will turn out to leave a different set of variables. Then we'll remove non-dynamical degrees of freedom. We'll find that some of the degrees of freedom here are non-dynamical, and that the action does not, in the sense that time derivatives of some fields do not appear in the action. At the end of this step, we'll have the action written in terms of a small number of degrees of freedom, a small number of fields, which are what we want to use in the end. There then follows a step which I'll call algebra avalanche. To write the action as a bunch of decoupled harmonic oscillators plus a small cubic correction, which is the form we need for the interaction picture. And then we just run the, then we just use, do the usual interaction picture analysis. And compute the quantities of interest, two-point function of zeta, two-point function of gamma, three-point function of zeta. Okay, let me give this board a home at the top so I can keep referring to it. The first step is to introduce the so-called ADM variables. This is a famous reparameterization of general relativity. The first step is to, the idea is to write the degrees of freedom of the metric, which are, GR is written in terms of this metric, G mu nu, and the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is, manifestly invariant under 3 plus 1 dimensional coordinate transformations. But for a Hamiltonian type situation where you want to start by giving the fields and some of their derivatives some values on an initial hypersurface and then evolve to the next hypersurface and so on, it's generally convenient to switch to the so-called ADM parameterization, which separates out the time direction where you choose a slicing and separate out the time direction explicitly. The way this works is actually, so this ADM paper is very famous for pointing this out. The way it works is algebraically very simple. So let me start with the metric. I haven't really done anything in this step. And this is useful for, in numerical relativity, ADM formulation plays a key role as well. Here's the metric with the time and space, time and space separated out explicitly. The ADM formulation starts by just writing the metric this way. So that I've done some sort of nonlinear change of variables. The original variables were G00, G0i, and Gij. And I've just changed variables here to a scalar n, a three-scalar n, a three-vector ni, and a three-metric hij. There's no physics in this step. It's just completing the square. All I did is rename. You could perform this nonlinear change of variables by, so first you just rename Gij to Hij. Then you define n upper I to be, I invert this three metric. This is the ni that I need so that when I multiply by h, I get g0i back. And then I just take n, you know, to be whatever's needed to make the dt squared component work out. That turns out to be this. So that's just completing the square to completing the square of some nonlinear change of variables. Useful about the ADM formalism is that you can write the Einstein-Hilbert action in a certain form. So this is the famous formula. So the action of in general relativity, the action for the metric alone, is this Einstein-Hilbert action, 1/2 the integral of square root minus g times r. It's conceptually clear. If you were stranded on a desert island and had to compute the Einstein-Hilbert action in these new variables, it's conceptually clear what you do. You just start with this form of the metric, and then just compute, run the usual GR machine, find formulas for the Christoffel symbols, then the Ricci curvature, then the scalar curvature, in these variables, and do a lot of algebra. In their famous paper, these guys, ADM, I've forgotten what the ADM stands for. Say again? Okay. Yeah, so those three guys did this exercise. It's a really long calculation. I mean, that's why it's a famous formula. This is what you get. So I'm not going to derive it. I think it would be a little too much of a detour, and I'm sort of classifying. Oops, sorry, I wrote more terms than I meant to. Here's the result. So this is a famous formula. I'm not going to derive it. It would be a little bit too much of a detour. Let's just say that if you made this change of variables in the first place, where you were going is probably applying this famous formula, where Eij here is... Dot I and j, j, I, and E is H, I, J, E, I, J. Okay, so a note on notation. When I work in this ADM picture, I'm going to do GR calculations, but they're always, I'm going to do differential geometry calculations. But they're always using the three metric Hij, not the four metric defined in this larger space. So for example, when I raise and lower indices here, I'm always raising and lowering them with the three metric, which is not the same thing that you would get if you raise them with the four metric and then stuck in spatial components. Likewise, covariant derivatives are always covariant derivatives defined with respect to the three metric. So this is maybe kind of an ugly thing to do. I'm taking this, you know, manifestly, this nice compact action, which is manifestly invariant under four-dimensional reparameterizations, and replacing it with this uglier thing where I've lost some of the symmetry. So this is manifestly invariant under parameterizations of the spatial dimensions, but time reparameterizations are not so, as Melisena says, not so obviously a symmetry. Nevertheless, the idiom formalism is very powerful. What's powerful about it is that if you stare at this action, you'll see that the fields N and Ni have the property that their time derivatives do not appear in the action. I forgot to say that R3 is the scalar curvature of the 3 metric. That was probably obvious from the notation. So the ADM action is organizing things so that it's explicitly separating out degrees of freedom which are non-dynamical in the sense that their time derivatives do not appear in the action. Spatial derivatives of Ni appear, but not time derivatives. What that means, if time derivatives don't appear in your action, is that when you write down the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion, you'll get instead of getting a differential equation in time, you'll get an algebraic equation with no time derivatives in it. In other words, time slice by time slice, there's an equation of motion, which is just an algebraic relation that's telling you how to solve for N and Ni in terms of the dynamical fields, which here are the Hijs. So, those Euler-Lagrange equations will have spatial derivatives, so the actual formula for N and Ni in terms of H will be a complicated thing with derivatives and antiderivatives, but it'll apply time slice by time slice. There won't be any dynamics in it. Okay. So just for the sake of doing a little calculation here, so I said this formula for the Einstein-Hilbert action was famous and I wasn't going to derive it, but I could derive, for example, the potential term in the action, which is the integral of this. So to change variables and put this in the ADM variables, I need to know what the square root, actually let's do a different term. Let's do this term. The kinetic term for phi. So I just want to change variables and write this in terms of N, Ni, Hij instead of G. And so in order to do that, I need formulas for the square root of minus g and g upper mu nu in ADM variables. The ADM variables are defined so that you read off a formula for g lower mu nu, but not for g upper mu nu. Any suggestions for how I would do this? So we definitely do want to take, you know, this 4x4 matrix and invert it. So that 4x4 matrix is minus n squared hij Is there any sort of nice way of inverting this matrix, or any sort of formula? You're absolutely right. If, for example, n sub I were 0, then this would be block diagonal, and I could write its inverse in terms of h upper ij. But the off diagonals are making things complicated here. Any sort of suggestion for how you would write this, invert this matrix? You're allowed to use, I'm going to allow myself to use on the right-hand side quantities like h upper ij, the inverse of the 3 metric, because those are sort of nice quantities in this 3 plus 0 dimensional geometry. I stared at this for a while. This is the sort of, this is why this calculation requires a lot of tricks. I sort of realized you could think about it this way. The metric in these lowered indices, you can sort of think of forming this metric in two steps. A step where, if I call the expression in parentheses dx prime, a step where you form dx primes out of dx's and dt's, and then a step where you combine those in a way that is diagonal, has the 1 plus 3 diagonalness. Another way of saying the same thing is that you can factor this matrix. Like this. Let's put 1, 3. Oh, sorry, I have this. I skipped a step. This should be ni. Okay, yeah. So the way that I sort of pair dx's up with this metric is by first applying this shift, which forms the dx primes out of the dx's, and then I multiply by this matrix in the middle. So that's g mu. So this lets you invert. This is probably not the only way to do it. You could probably start with this and play around. There's something called the Woodbury formula that tells you how when you change a few entries in a matrix, like you would know how to invert it if there were zeros here. There's something called the Woodbury formula that tells you when you change a small number of entries in a matrix how the inverse changes. So there's probably a more brute force approach that would work. But this approach was the way to go. So if I invert this, what's the inverse of this matrix? Anyone know offhand what the inverse of this guy would be? Oh, well, that's true for any matrix. Yeah, it's useful to know if you have a block matrix like this, that the way that you invert is that you just put a minus sign here. You could check that and multiply it out, easily enough and check. So if I invert, so inverting reverses the order. And so inverting, I get this. Minus n, minus 2, h upper ij, 1. I invert this matrix and put in its minus sign. Okay. So now I can compute, for example, I found it easiest to leave the answer in this form and not multiply out. If I want to compute, for example, g upper mu nu. If I want to compute, for example, the product g upper mu nu del mu phi del nu phi, then I just put in, I'm just multiplying by the vector phi dot del I phi here and by the vector phi dot del I phi here. I guess this should be J for consistency with how I'm indexing things. And then you can then I found it easiest to just multiply this, multiply the whole chain through from right to left. You end up with this result. Okay. What about square root of minus g? How would you take the determinant of g in this ADM variables? Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that also, once you have this factorization telling you how the telling you this factorization, you know, is just a nice way of thinking about the four metric in the ADM variables. Then you just take the determinant. The determinant of a product of matrices is the product of the determinants. These guys on the outside have determinant 1. This guy on the inside, you just multiply together. And you get n minus n squared just n, since I have the square root here, times the square root of h. Okay, so putting this together, s phi, this action, is 1/2 integral dt dx square root h minus ni del I phi squared minus n to a del j. I've successfully expressed this 3 plus 1 dimensional kinetic term as a bunch of geometric objects with respect to the 3 metric in the slicing. Likewise, the potential part of the action, by our formula for square root minus g, is just minus integral dt dtx. Let's write this as d4. N times v of phi. Okay. So putting all of this together, we get the following action. Which is going to be the end of step one, just changing variables in the action to ADM gauge. Let's call this S ADM. Where all derivatives and curvatures are with respect to the 3 plus 0 dimensional metric Aij, the variable Eij, well, let me just put it. Variable Eij is defined by 1/2 Hij dot cov I and j. And E is Hij E. Okay. So now we can think of the degrees of freedom in this theory as being a dynamical three metric Hij, these non-dynamical fields n and the scalar field n and ni and the scalar field phi. Okay. Next step is fixing the gauge. So let me remind you that in general relativity is invariant under coordinate transformations. I can always reparameterize, define a new set of coordinates x prime, which are just some arbitrary nonlinear function of the old coordinates x. And all the physics will look the same to observers that use the prime down and prime coordinate systems. So for example, in inflation, we think about the field phi as acquiring fluctuations around its homogeneous, spatially homogeneous background solution. But that's actually a gauge-dependent statement. I could always choose, let's suppose that in an arbitrary set of coordinates, I find that phi has fluctuations, so that when I draw the surfaces of equal phi, they're not homogeneous. Well, that just means that they don't coincide with the surfaces of constant time. But if I define a new time coordinate to make them the same, in other words, I just define my time coordinate to be well, I could take the time coordinate to be phi itself, for example. Then in that primed coordinate system, in that new coordinate system, by definition, phi has no spatial fluctuations, and it just looks the same, that it would in an FRW background. Of course, what's happened here is that I've moved the fluctuations that were originally in phi into the metric. So there'll be some gauge-independent combination of phi degrees of freedom and metric degrees of freedom that is the same in both coordinate systems, but it's actually just a choice, just a matter of which coordinates you choose, whether we think of the fluctuation in single field slow roll inflation as being a fluctuation in phi or a fluctuation in the metric or in some combination of the two. Independence of coordinate system means that there will be certain modes that are unconstrained. There's always, if I make an infinitesimal coordinate change, that will appear to act on the basic degrees of freedom, the phi and the degrees of freedom of the metric, in such a way that the action doesn't change. And that means that those gauge degrees of freedom don't have any equation of motion. If I try to derive an equation of motion by minimizing the action, I'll just get nothing. I'll get like 0 = 0 because the action doesn't change when I move in certain directions. So it's best at a technical level, the best thing to do is to remove this ambiguity by choosing some prescription which makes the coordinate system unique. And writing down the action in this uniquely determined set of coordinates. And that'll also have the advantage of removing some degrees of freedom from the theory that are just superfluous gauge degrees of freedom. So Maldacena chooses the following gauge. You should get the same answer for these observables in the end, regardless of which gauge you choose, but we have to make a choice to calculate, and Maldacena's choice is the following. So choose, define space and time coordinates such that the following are true. So I want phi to just depend on time with no x dependence. This is, in fact, exactly the change of variables that I was talking about here, where you just choose the surfaces of constant time to be surfaces of constant phi. That fixes the time reparameterization part of the gauge. Choose the spatial part of the gauge so that the metric has this form. So if I take my metric in ADM gauge, my three metric, so let me just write down Maldacena's prescription and then we'll motivate it. Okay. Sorry, this should be Delta. Okay. By the way, a note on notation is that I got confused. You want to be careful because you don't want to just write something like gamma I here. Or I found it confusing because there's two ways to raise and lower metrics. You could either raise and lower with the Kronecker delta, or you could raise and lower with the three metric H. So I to avoid confusing myself, I found it convenient to always write raising and lowerings with the Kronecker delta out explicitly, and reserve the implicit raising and lowering of index notation for cases where I was raising and lowering with H. Okay, so let's talk about this gauge. So intuitively, the first comment is that you'll notice that Mandelson is defining the gauge here to second order. He didn't find it necessary to include a gamma cubed term here. That's because you might think that since we're calculating to third order, that we would need to know the gauge to third order. And that is indeed generally true if you wanted to work out how some, say some gauge-dependent quantity, like even the Ricci, even the scalar curvature, depends on these variables zeta and gamma that we've defined in the gauge choice, you would generally need to know the gauge to you would generally need to know the gauge to third order. But if we're specifically interested in calculating the action to third order, then it turns out you only need to know the gauge to second order. So the reason that's true is that imagine that I made some shift in the fields of the theory, the G and the metric and phi. Let's write those fields collectively as psi. So S is some function of psi, where psi stands for all the degrees of freedom of the metric and phi. If I were to change the fields by, say, some third order perturbation, something which is third order in the fluctuations, let's say order epsilon cubed, then that shifts the action by. So I'm starting at the FRW background, I make a small perturbation, and then I shift by an additional amount, which is third order in the original perturbation. So that shifts the action to lowest order by its functional derivative, the derivative of the action with respect to the variables, del psi times delta psi. Let's say delta psi is order epsilon cubed. Because I'm only shifted off the background solution at first order, the equations of motion, so this guy, the derivative of the action with respect to the fields, this derivative is the equations of motion. And because I'm off the background solution at first order, the equations of motion are satisfied to first order. And so that means that I'm multiplying something first order in the fluctuations by an additional shift that's third order in the fluctuations. I get something which is fourth order, not third order. So for purposes of expanding the action in the gauge variables, you just need to know the gauge to second order. To sort of make sense out of Maldacena's prescription here, so the condition that this gamma object is traceless and that this contraction of derivatives, I contract one derivative with gamma, I get zero, intuitively is what I think of when I talk about a gravity wave. A gravity wave propagates in some direction k. It's some disturbance in the metric that propagates with some direction k. And it has no, if I dot k, with delta g, I should get zero. In other words, the gravity wave doesn't excite components of the metric in the k direction. And it should also be traceless. There's no net. A gravity wave is like a little quadrupole in expansion and contraction of space that propagates along with no net increase or decrease in the volume. So delta g ii should be zero. So intuitively, what's happening here is that Malmsteen is separating out the metric into a gravity wave-like part and an overall expansion part, which is a scalar. At a technical level, what's happening is that you might notice that what is being written down here are the first two terms in the expansion of e to the gamma, where gamma is a matrix, and this is the matrix exponential. So Malmsteen is choosing this gauge so that the determinant of h, since gamma is traceless, e to the gamma will have determinant 1. Or more properly, the determinant will be 1 to third order in gamma because the gauge is only defined at second order. So Malmsteen is choosing his gauge so that the determinant of what's in brackets is 1, and if it's not equal to 1, you just pull out whatever the determinant is and put it into the zeta. So this property of the gauge is actually not anything that you need to fix by a coordinate transformation. It's just the definition of gamma. You just pull out the determinant, call that zeta, and then whatever's left is e to the gamma. So you just take the log of whatever's left, and that's gamma. This condition, the condition that the derivative suitably contracted of the log of the metric is 0, is the gauge condition, and that's what you need a coordinate transformation to pin down. Now, intuitively, it made sense to me that one can make a coordinate transformation so that this condition is satisfied. The reason that's intuitive is because an infinitesimal gauge transformation is parameterized by a 4 vector. So at infinitesimal level, a coordinate transformation works by shifting coordinates by some 4 vector. You know, there's some little 4 vector that tells me how coordinate values in one coordinate system are related to coordinate values in the other coordinate system. And I've already used up the time part of that gauge transformation in removing the spatial fluctuations from phi. So what I have left sort of has 1 3 vectors worth of I have 1 3 vectors worth of freedom to define the coordinate system. And this gauge condition is a condition, you know, it has 1 index. So I'm trying to set the single 3 vector to 0. So at the level of counting degrees of freedom, it made sense. There's a 3 vector that I want to set to 0. There's a 3 vector that I'm free to choose. And so the number of degrees of freedom match, so I ought to be able to make it work. If you wanted to prove, I did, just for the sake of dotting. Just for the sake of dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's, write down a little proof that that's possible. So if you were so let me just ask, if you wanted to give a math proof that it's always possible to do this. So I can forget about the time dimension here and just say if I have a 3 metric hij, which is, let's forget about the of t, u the 2 zeta. So here's the mathematical statement. This line is just the definition. For any three metric h, I can always define zeta and gamma so that this is true, where the trace of gamma is zero. How would you, but I want to prove that I can always, by means of a coordinate transformation, arrange that this three vector vanishes. How would you go about trying to prove that statement? I found this scale a little non-trivial. I had to play around a little. What you might try is just seeing what, trying to do this, say, to lowest order. If I assume that this f is small, can I arrange, if I forget about higher order terms, can I construct an infinitesimal gauge transformation? Let me write i's, since I'm just in three dimensions. Which sets it to zero. So, if I linearize an epsilon, I'll have some linear equation between epsilon and f that I can try to solve. So I did that exercise of just seeing how f transforms under an infinitesimal gauge transformation. Since we just have like 60 seconds left, I'll just write out the answer. So you can show that under this infinitesimal transformation epsilon, f shifts by, if I write it down in Fourier space, let's write it down in real space. So a short calculation shows that if I make this change of variables, work out how the metric changes, translate that to a shift in zeta and gamma, put that into the definition of f, I get some result for a first order shift in f. The correction here is of order gamma times epsilon, the next term. So there's some differential operator that's relating delta f to epsilon. And the thing to notice is that it's invertible. If you just look at this one Fourier mode at a time, at lowest order, delta fi of k is just 1/3 ki kj plus k squared delta ij. I guess there's a minus sign. Times epsilon jk. And this matrix is an invertible matrix for every k. So I can always shift, given an f, I can always shift, make an infinitesimal gauge transformation to get rid of f. Well, I didn't keep track of terms of order gamma times epsilon. So f won't be precisely zero. It'll just be non-zero at the next order in perturbation theory. But that's OK. I can just iterate to completely remove f. Like if I start with an f, if I define zeta and gamma this way for an arbitrary metric, I would get an f generally that was first order in gamma. I make this transformation, and then the correction terms I didn't keep track of were of order gamma squared. Then when I iterate, the next epsilon I choose will be of order gamma squared, so the corrections will be gamma cubed, and so on. And in this way, I can make f as small as I want in any order of perturbation theory. I'm afraid I didn't quite follow that. You're saying this? That's a good question. So the derivative here is not exactly the same as the covariant derivative, right? That is true. So I think you would find that that's a totally sensible gauge choice. So it would be a totally sensible gauge choice to say that, to use this gauge. This is not the same thing as saying that. So this is always true to arbitrary order in gamma. This will be non-zero at some order in gamma. This is probably a reasonable gauge choice too. This would be a slightly different gauge that would differ at second order, but the same argument would work. You'd find the same operator here. So anyway, if you ever want to check that some reasonable looking gauge actually works, at least perturbatively, all that you need to do is linearize under a first order gauge transformation and just check that this matrix that appears at a given Fourier mode K is invertible. Then there's a formal argument that says you can iterate to remove, fix your gauge to whatever order in perturbation theory you need. So I didn't go as far as I had hoped. Next time,